Matt graduated from Cornell. He was a student at Sabachaki. He moved to Princeton, to the Center for Theoretical Science at Princeton. He was among the very first postdocs there. Matt worked on an amazing variety of projects. He was one of the very first people to write on spin measurements at the LHC. He then wrote papers on, for example, string excitations from Randall Centrum at the LHC. Yeah, they were the first to write down the full characterization of non-relativistic Lagrangian as dark matter drag detection. And most recently, they've made a very important contribution to our knowledge of supersymmetry, or our knowledge of what's not there. And I guess you'll tell us all about it today.
Okay, thank you. All right, so I'll be telling you about what the LHC has to say so far about supersymmetry in the Higgs and what might be coming up in the future. It seems obligatory to start a talk on the LHC with a photo like this, where you can see that the LHC is a very large machine near Geneva and near the Alps. And you see a lot of beautiful images that come out of it, of the detector and these very clean objects that are identified, and some of these very compelling events where you create some interesting particles. But you might also see images like this that come out of the LHC, and you know, this is what happens more typically. You get a mess. You get lots of particles everywhere, and it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. In fact, this particular example from ATLAS had 7 different interactions happening at the same time, because they're not just colliding individual protons, they're colliding bunches of protons, and you can have several interactions happening simultaneously. So the real challenge is to sort of dig through all of these things that you get and try to learn something about physics. Okay, so I'm actually, because I know some of you in the audience are not particle physicists, I'm going to try to make the first half of this talk very accessible to everyone, and I'm going to start out at a basic level, so I apologize for boring those of you who are particle physicists. But I want to explain to you why we have a puzzle, that there's a hierarchy of the different force strengths in nature, and tell you a little bit about why supersymmetry might be an answer. And then the last half of the talk, I want to tell you about the actual results that are coming from the LHC and related to both the Higgs and supersymmetry, and where we might be going in the future. Okay, so to begin with, I'll just tell you some things that we know very well about the forces in nature. So we have several forces in nature, and they have strengths which are energy dependent. So in particular, if you think about electric charge, for example, if you have some charged object, then in the quantum vacuum, there are lots of charged particles and antiparticles that you can think of as sort of popping in and out of existence, short-lived virtual particles. And they're going to sort of tend to align themselves in such a way that they will screen the charge of a fundamental particle. And that means that in a quantum theory like quantum electrodynamics, charge is a distance-dependent or energy-dependent quantity. If you probe this with a more energetic probe, you can sort of punch through this cloud of stuff and see more of the actual bare charge that was here. If you probe it with something less energetic, you're going to see more of the screening effect. And it's a screening effect much like in condensed matter physics, where you can have this happening inside real materials. But in quantum field theory, we're interested in this, where it's really the vacuum that's doing this. And so we have this vacuum polarization effect, that the sort of potential that you can have in QED is not just a 1 over r Coulomb potential, it's modified by some sort of distance-dependent permittivity of the vacuum. Okay, so in particular, the strength of the electromagnetic force seems to get stronger at shorter distances and weaker at longer distances. On the other hand, we have some very different forces in nature, like the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force is the force that binds together protons and neutrons, which are made out of different quarks. And it's a very strong force at long distances. So at long distances, we don't see any free quarks. We always see them confined into hadrons like this. They form color singlet states where there's no visible remnant of the elementary particles that are making up these protons and neutrons at long distances. And we say that that's called confinement. And you can think of that as being a similar sort of vacuum polarization effect, but in a more complicated way. In particular, it's going the opposite direction from an electromagnetism. It's making the force stronger at longer distances instead of weaker. It's a little bit hard to understand that in terms of a picture of these dipoles that are screening a charge. But if you think in terms of a magnetic picture, it's a little bit easier to understand. So the strong force, just like electromagnetism, has both electric and magnetic manifestations. And if you put the theory in an external magnetic field, where here I mean a color magnetic field, a strong force magnetic field, gluons, which are the force-carrying particles, analogous to photons, are charged under the force itself, and they also have spin. And there's a sort of paramagnetic effect where their spins tend to align with an external applied color magnetic field. And you can think of that as affecting the permeability of the vacuum, mu. But in a relativistic theory, the speed of light is fixed, and so the product of a permittivity and permeability are related. So once you can understand this magnetic effect, which affects the permeability, you know that there has to be a corresponding effect on the permittivity. And that's the effect that makes this force stronger at longer distances. And this point of view on this effect of asymptotic freedom, which is the fact that the force is weak at short distances, was explained by N.K. Nielsen in 1981. And it's maybe a more intuitive way than the usual way we think in terms of Feynman diagrams and typical quantum field theory. Okay. So if I've told you that we have a force like electromagnetism that's getting stronger at short distances and a force like the strong nuclear force that's getting weaker at short distances, one thing that we're inclined to wonder about is whether all the forces might somehow be the same strength at some distance scale, and maybe that's a remnant of something interesting that happens there. And you can do this calculation in the standard model. This is 1 over the force strength plotted on the vertical axis, 1 over the force strength just because that gives me simple lines in this plot instead of some other kind of curve. And so at the top, we have the weakest force, which is hypercharge, which is roughly like electromagnetism, except that at higher energies, it's not quite the electromagnetism we know at low energies. In the middle, we have the weak nuclear force, and at the bottom, the strong nuclear force. And you can see that they're sort of moving in the direction of having equal strengths, but it doesn't quite work. These three lines don't all cross at one point in the standard model, that is. Okay. So those are the basic forces of particle physics, but of course there's another very important force in the world around us, and that's gravity. And gravity is, in some sense, the force that we've understood for the longest. Newton gave us an understanding of it that works pretty well, and Einstein updated it to take into account relativity. But on the other hand, gravity is in many ways the most mysterious force when you combine the existence of black holes, which is a prediction of yeah.
Can I ask a question before back
yeah.
to the previous part?
Yeah.
So when you're comparing the compact constants of these different theories, are you really comparing apples and oranges? Because, I mean, okay, compact constant to order of one tells you whether the theory is perturbative or non-perturbative. But then a compact constant of QED is not really the same thing as compact constant of QCD. So, I mean, is there really much significance? Like, these numbers aren't exactly, I mean, they're very close to each other.
Well, they're coming somewhat close, but if they were really, so if they were really manifestations, if all of these forces unified into a single force at some energy scale, then above that energy scale, you would expect them all to have exactly the same coupling constant, because above that scale, it really would be one force, not different forces. Now, yeah.
As a coupling constant, it's somewhat arbitrary.
Well. Once you, I mean, to some extent that's true. You can sort of rescale what you're calling the coupling constant. And in fact, there is a rescaling between what we usually think of as the hypercharge coupling constant and what it would be if it was unified into one force.
Yeah.
But if you're imagining that this comes from a given unified group like SU5, which can break to the standard model groups, once you assume that all of this embeds in SU5, there's a unique way to determine which rescaling of that coupling constant you want to use. So the normal thing that we call the hypercharge coupling, if you want to fit it into SU5, turns out to have to be scaled by the square root of 5/3. And that's sort of going into these lines. And so you would expect that if you normalize them properly, that they would all become the same above some energy scale. And then it's true that right around that scale, there's a lot of physical stuff that happens. There's new matter there. And you can get various corrections, which would make them not quite unify exactly. But this failure to unify is large enough that kind of correction isn't really enough to fix it and to make all of this
that,
work.
That 20% discrepancy is enough so that you won't be able to put it in an SU5 theory.
Right. Okay. So to get back to gravity. So gravity is going to play very little role in what I'm going to tell you about today, except that it's an extremely weak force, and that's what really leads to one of the major puzzles that we care about in particle physics. So you know that we could measure the strength of the gravitational force in terms of Newton's constant. We can rewrite that in terms of a mass scale using other fundamental constants like h bar and c, and that mass scale turns out to be 10 to the 19 GeV, where a GeV is about the mass of a proton. So this is 19 orders of magnitude larger than a typical scale in particle physics. You could also rewrite it as a distance scale, which is many orders of magnitude smaller than the distance scales of particle physics. And that's a puzzling fact. It's a puzzling fact, but it's also a crucial fact to making the world around us look like it does. And so one familiar illustration of that that you've probably seen before is that a magnet can lift an object even though the entire Earth is pulling on that object. That's a manifestation of the weakness of gravity. I want to try to give you a slightly different illustration of why it's important to us that gravity is very weak. So without gravity being much weaker than the other forces, I would claim that the entire world around us would be very different. In particular, if you think about the sizes of objects around us in the universe, something like a planet, its size is actually related to this interplay between the different forces. So let's think about a planet where we have matter in the sort of normal phases that it exists in the world around us. The structure of matter is determined by different interactions, like electrostatic interactions. And these have some typical energy scale. So a sort of typical electrostatic interaction between atoms you could estimate as being set by the electromagnetic interaction strength E squared divided by the Bohr radius A naught. On the other hand, if you have some atom near the outside of a planet, then it also has a gravitational potential energy coming from its interaction with the rest of the planet. And that scales like G Newton times the mass of the atom times the mass of the planet divided by the radius of the planet. Okay, so we can imagine that if we lived in a world where gravity was not much weaker than the other forces, this gravitational potential energy could become large enough that it could start to affect the structure of matter in a significant way. And in particular, if we want to sort of imagine what's the largest possible planet where the structure of matter isn't seriously deformed by the action of gravity, you could equate these two energy scales. And we can do that by assuming the mass of the planet is just given by its volume times the mass of an atom. And then if we equate these things, we find that the forces roughly balance when the radius of a planet in units of the Bohr radius, so some typical atomic distance scale or some distance scale that's related to particle physics, scales like the strength of the electric force divided by the strength of the gravitational force measured in terms of the square root of G Newton times the mass of an atom, which is the same as saying it scales like the Planck mass divided by the mass of an atom. And so this 10 to the 19 factor between the mass scale at which gravity becomes strong and the masses of particle physics is exactly the large factor that's allowing us to live on sort of a large world like the one around us, where gravity is weak enough that the structure of matter is determined more by particle physics and gravity is not playing a strong role. So this hierarchy of energy scales is very important. It's a basic property of the universe around us. And if it wasn't true, we would live in a very different world. So it's a feature of our world. And you could wonder, why isn't it just a fact? We have these different forces. They have very different strengths. What's wrong with that? You know, this number of 10 to the 19, we might not understand it, but we measure it. And it could just be a fact about our world. The reason why we see it as being a little bit more of a problem, or at least a puzzle, comes in only when we talk about the Higgs boson in the Standard Model of Particle Physics. So to briefly tell you what the Higgs is some field that permeates the entire vacuum. And other particles get mass by their interactions with it. So roughly, you can think of some particle that would have been massless that's zipping along at the speed of light, except that it keeps bumping into the Higgs field. And that interaction with the Higgs field gives it an effective mass. So why does the Higgs have a value everywhere in space? It has some sort of potential, so it's a scalar field. And at zero, it's at the top of the hill. So it wants to minimize its energy and flow down to the bottom of the hill. And that means you get a non-zero value of this field everywhere in space. So one problem with the Standard Model, one thing that isn't very satisfying, is we assume that this potential exists, but we don't explain it. It's just put in by hand. And it's really analogous, if you're familiar with Landau-Ginzburg theory and condensed matter physics, it's some sort of effective description of an order parameter that we put in to explain why the low energy physics looks the way that it does. But there's really no microscopic details behind it. And it could just be that there's some fundamental potential like this, but most of us think there's probably a more satisfying explanation of where this comes from. OK, so this potential leads the Higgs to have an expectation value throughout space and time. there's some number, and we know what that number is because we've measured the masses of things that get mass by interacting with it. It's about 250 GeV. And other particles get masses determined by the strength of their interaction with the Higgs times this expectation value of the Higgs field. So in the case of the W boson, it's about 80 GeV. In the case of the top quark, which is the thing that we've seen that interacts most strongly with the Higgs, this coupling constant and this normalization is about 1 over the square root of 2, and the mass is about 173 GeV. OK. Now, the Higgs leads to what we call the hierarchy problem, which is what turns this discrepancy in the strength of the gravitational force and the other forces from just a fact about the world into a real puzzle that makes us think that there's other physics that we don't understand. So to explain that problem, the Higgs interacts with the top quark. We know that that's the interaction that's giving the top quark its mass. But that interaction allows the Higgs field to split into a virtual top and antitop, which can then recombine and make a Higgs. And this interaction gives a shift in the Higgs mass. And the shift in the Higgs mass comes from integrating over all the possible states of the top and antitop that can appear in this quantum loop correction. And in fact, this integral is divergent. So there are different momenta that the top and antitop can have. And when you integrate over the momentum, you get an answer that scales like the square of whatever the largest momentum that you've allowed yourself to consider is. Another way to say that, if you prefer not to think in terms of Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory, is just in terms of ordinary second-order perturbation theory in quantum mechanics, there's some interaction Hamiltonian that connects a Higgs boson to different states made out of a top quark and an antitop quark. And there are shifts in the Higgs energy that come from those states. And when you sum over all of them, you get a divergent sum that depends on the largest energy states that you allow yourself to consider. So the upshot of all of that is that we expect that there's some quantum correction in the Higgs mass, which is as large as the largest energy scales in the problem. And because of the existence of gravity, which we measure to be associated with the mass scale of M Planck, we expect that that correction can be of order 10 to the 18 GeV. So a very large correction if the energy scales that are accessible are as large as the apparent energy scale at which gravity becomes strong. On the other hand, we measure a Higgs mass, if you believe the LHC results, of about 125 GeV. Even if it's not totally clear yet that they found the Higgs, certainly the Higgs has to be light if it's going to play the role that it plays in the standard model. And so we have a number here which is 125, or certainly not more than 1,000. And it's the sum of some number that's 10 to the 18 and another number. And that means the number we started with, the sort of initial value of the mass, must have been absurdly close to the thing that we calculated as the correction, even though a priori they look like unrelated numbers. So this is the major problem with the standard model of particle physics. It seems to require that two numbers that shouldn't have been related agree with each other to many, many decimal places, and somehow only differ at a very high decimal place. So it's like things are tuned to cancel to many digits of precision. And that's a real puzzle. OK, so I told you that there was this discrepancy in energies, or in the strengths of different forces and in the corresponding energy scales associated with them. And I've told you that that becomes a puzzle in the context of the Higgs boson. And you might ask me, why do I have to talk about the Higgs boson to tell you this? We know other particles like the electron or the proton, which have small masses. Why do those particles not already give rise to a hierarchy problem? And the answer is that the Higgs is special. The Higgs is the only particle in the standard model that doesn't have spin. It's a scalar field. It has no spin degree of freedom. And in fact, because of that, it's the only particle in the standard model that gives rise to the hierarchy problem. So I want to explain to you why particles with spin don't give rise to the hierarchy problem. So for instance, the electron mass is much smaller than the Planck scale. Why doesn't it also get large quantum corrections? So to do that, I need to tell you a little bit about particles with spin. If you think about particles that have spin and they're moving in some direction, you can define something called the helicity, which is which way they're spinning relative to their direction of motion. So in this case, I'm showing you a particle that's moving to the left and spinning in this direction. So this is a right-handed particle. Its spin is oriented in a right-handed way around its direction of motion. Now, if this was a massive particle and it's moving slower than the speed of light, then I can say, let's move in the same direction that it's moving, but even faster. And then in my reference frame, it's now moving backwards, but it's still spinning in the same direction. And so when I change reference frames, it switched from being a right-handed particle to being a left-handed particle. in terms of which way it's spinning relative to its direction of motion. And so that tells me that the helicity of this particle was not really an intrinsic property of the particle. It depends on the reference frame that I'm in when I ask the question. On the other hand, if the particle was massless, it's moving at the speed of light, and then no matter how fast I go, I can't go to a frame where it's moving in the opposite direction. And in that case, its helicity is fixed. No matter which frame I'm in, I measure the same thing. And so that tells us that for particles with spin, there's really a difference between massive and massless particles in a relativistic theory. The technical statement of this is that they live in different representations of the Lorentz group, but you can see from the simple physical argument that they're different. And that means that the quantum corrections to the mass of these particles must be proportional to the mass, because if you start with zero, you need to still have zero in the end. Otherwise, you would somehow not be consistent with this difference between the way helicity works for massive and massless particles. And so for particles with spin, we don't have a hierarchy problem because the quantum corrections to their mass are proportional to the mass that you started with. So it's only for the Higgs that we do. And this suggests a way to solve the hierarchy problem, which is to demand that somehow the mass of these spinless particles, like the Higgs, is related to the mass of a particle with spin, which is protected from quantum corrections. And if you could tie those things together, then you would start to protect the Higgs from the quantum corrections in the same way that the other particles are protected. And that's what supersymmetry does. And that's really the basic reason why in particle physics we believe that supersymmetry might show up at the energy scales we're probing. Yeah?
In the standard model, you can't get self images W and Z.
Yeah.
They are protected.
Sorry, what?
W and Z is still one.
Yes.
So it's an integer.
Right. They're particles with spin, and so they don't have these large corrections.
It's an issue, spin
and no spin. Right. So yeah, nothing I said was specific to spin 1/2. Really, it's anything with spin. Yeah. 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 Okay. So. So that's the reason why we believe supersymmetry might play a role in particle physics. And in particular, the version of supersymmetry that we usually care about is what's called the minimal supersymmetric standard model, which was written down by Demopoulos and Georgi in 1981. And that starts with the degrees of freedom that we know in the standard model and adds the minimal set of new degrees of freedom that you need to make the theory supersymmetric. And that means that for every fermion that we know, it's going to be linked with some boson. And for every boson we know, it's going to be linked with some fermion. So in particular, we know fermions like the electron. Those become linked with scalars called the selectron, for instance. The quarks become linked with scalars called squarks. So for instance, the top quark is linked with the scalar called the scalar top or the stop. All the force-carrying bosons we know are also linked with superparticles. So for instance, the gluons that mediate the strong nuclear force are now tied with gluinos that are fermions. The W bosons for the weak force are paired with winos. And then the Higgs, which was a scalar, is going to have a fermionic partner. But in fact, to make the theory work, you need two Higgs doublets. So two Higgs doublet scalars that are also paired with associated fermions called Higgsinos. OK. And now concretely, how does this work? I've told you that if you try to connect particles with and without spin, you can cancel these large quantum corrections. But in practice, how does that manifest itself? The way it works is if the Higgs could have split into a loop of top quarks and anti-top quarks. Now, in a supersymmetric theory, it can turn into a loop of the scalar top quark and an anti-scalar top quark. And when you add up these pieces where the things circulating in the loop have different spins, these pieces cancel, and the largest corrections vanish. In particular, if you had exact supersymmetry, you could completely cancel all the quadratic divergences. And the limit where supersymmetry is not exact, for instance, maybe the mass of the scalar top quark and the top quark differ, then you'll have a leftover piece which relates to how large that difference is. And so the larger the mass of this particle in the loop is, the less completely you're canceling the divergences and the more of the hierarchy problem you would have left over. Okay, so that was the motivation for supersymmetry in terms of the hierarchy problem. It turns out, for free, you sort of get another nice reason why you might believe in supersymmetry, which is that once you make the set of assumptions that there are new particles that exist near the weak scale that are canceling the divergences from these loops, those particles will also contribute to the quantum effects that lead the different forces to have different strengths at different energy scales. So when you do the calculation of the force strengths extrapolated to short distances, I showed you that in the standard model it doesn't really work. If you do the same calculation in the minimal supersymmetric standard model, this is just the one loop quantum calculation, and you can see that you have three lines which now meet to very high accuracy. And so I should emphasize that this is really an empirical fact about the world. This isn't just a theoretical fact about this model. It's the fact that the measured values that we see at low energies, when you evaluate them and extrapolate to short distances, actually have this property that they meet. So it's a pretty compelling fact. The original calculations of this unification were worked out in the 80s, but the numbers weren't really measured precisely enough until the LEP experiment in the 90s to see that this was a very accurate unification. OK, so now I'm going to start moving on to tell you about the LHC and what it's telling us about this whole picture and whether the picture makes sense. So before the LHC, if you ask many theorists what would a supersymmetry spectrum look like, they would give you something like this. OK, and this is complicated, but you can see there are many different particles here. There's a gluino, for instance, a superpartner of the gluon. There are superpartners of the different squarks, for instance, the top, the bottom, and the other squarks. And you might have expected those particles to be a little bit heavy, but maybe still something like 500, 600 GeV. So they could have been easily produced at the LHC. You also have partners of the Higgs, the W, the hypercharged gauge boson, partners of the leptons. And so there were many particles here, and they could decay in many different ways. You might produce a gluino, and it might decay to a quark and a squark. It might decay to a top and a stop. The stop might decay, for instance, to a bottom and a wino, or a top and a bino. So lots of things could happen in the spectrum. And there was a lot of room here, lots of different parameters and lots of different places to put these parameters. And so you can see just from that picture that it's a mess. You have hundreds of parameters, many new particles. They all have their own mass scale. They can decay in different ways, interact in different ways. And it's hard to make sense of that large parameter space. So one thing that was traditionally done was to define models that reduce the parameter space to smaller subspaces. And this could be somewhat arbitrary. You might have a model where you say that all the scalar masses are equal, at least at some short distance scale. And when you do that, you get results, which a lot of the results that have come out of experiments look like this. They're phrased in terms of some simplified parameter space, where they take a slice through this 100-dimensional parameter space and try to reduce it to something tractable. And so here, m-naught is the mass of every scalar in the theory. They're assumed to all be the same mass at some short distance scale, at the gut scale. Yeah?
So you said there are hundreds of parameters, but for all choices of those hundreds of parameters, do those GTFs meet at the same point, the coupling constant?
Right, so the unification of the coupling constants is relatively insensitive to the details because it mostly depends on how these particles interact with the gauge fields, which is determined by their representations under different symmetries and not by tunable parameters. On the other hand, if you made the masses extremely different, so if you made some of those particles extremely heavy, for instance, then you're going to have the strength of the force is going to run according to the standard model until you hit that mass scale, and then it's going to be deflected. And so if you spread the masses out over many orders of magnitude, then you would no longer have this precise unification.
So you don't want them to be too heavy.
You don't want them to be too heavy. But as long as they're sort of near the weak scale, then this works fairly well. And in fact, there's another scenario where only the fermions need to be near the weak scale, and the scalars can be heavier. And that can still work fairly well. So there are a few different options that work well. And within those options, it's pretty robust as long as you don't start extremely distorting the spectrum in really extreme ways.
You also have to preserve proton stability.
That's right, yeah. Which means that the scale where they unify shouldn't be too low. And that's...
extrapolating by 14 orders of magnitude.
Right. Well, you have to, right, it's assuming that there isn't other new physics coming in at lower scales that's going to seriously change this prediction. So that's an assumption. OK, so you would see results that come out of the experiment that are phrased in terms of things like this, where m1/2 is a scale for all the fermions, and m0 a scale for all the scalars. And these scales are specified at the unification scale. And the problem is that it's a little bit hard to interpret something like this, because these are parameters specified at the gut scale. In order to know the actual masses of the physical particles, I have to renormalization group evolve those parameters down to low energies. And so they would tell us, for instance, that this black curve, everything below the black curve has been ruled out by data. And then you have to go back and see what that actually means in terms of masses. You know, this is a mass of only 200 GeV in terms of a mass scale that's specified at the high scale. But in terms of low scale parameters, that might be a mass of 600 or 700. And so you have to, it's not so easy to figure out in terms of physical things like masses what this means. But some of the work that's been coming out has been phrased more directly in terms of masses. And so that's a very useful thing to do. So ATLAS, for instance, has this sort of simplified model plot in terms of the low scale masses of gluinos and squarks. And this is much easier to interpret. It tells you that the gluino mass is bounded at something like 800 GeV. And if gluinos and squarks are the same mass, they're bounded at something like 1 TeV. And that's the kind of claim you might have been hearing when people say that supersymmetry is becoming strongly constrained and the superpartners have to be above 1 TeV. That is true for certain sets of assumptions about the spectrum. On the other hand, we really have a few options now. The first option is maybe all the superpartners are above about a TeV, so all the squarks, the gluinos, all of these strongly interacting particles. And if that's true, then the stop mass contribution to the Higgs isn't really canceling the top mass very well, because you're starting to make the mass splitting between them too big. And so in that case, you necessarily have some sort of tuning and electroweak symmetry breaking. On the other hand, these limits that are really strong are really for the light flavor squarks, the ones that decay to a light quark and a neutralino, for instance. They're not so relevant directly for the stops and spottoms, and I'll show you more of this shortly. But one idea is that you might have what's called flavored or natural supersymmetry, things where the flavor structure of the standard model, so the fact that the top quark behaves very differently from the light quarks, also means that the corresponding superpartner of the top might behave differently from the superpartners of the light quarks. And in that case, we could still have some of these particles be light. And finally, it could be that all the particles are light, but they're hidden, so the normal searches that are being done for them don't apply, and there are a lot of options there too. So these are the sort of three basic categories that you can fit most of the current ideas about supersymmetry into. So what I want to tell you about specifically is about this case of natural supersymmetry, where you might have light scalar top quarks that are canceling the loops for the Higgs. And this is something I've been thinking about off and on for several years. I wrote a paper with Patrick Mead in 2006, where we focused on this scenario where you only consider the things that are playing the most important role in solving the hierarchy problem. So you think in particular about spectra where the scalar top quark is canceling the largest divergence in the Higgs mass. And you try to ignore the other particles, or at least focus on the signals that would really isolate this particle, so that you don't have to consider this this full messy diagram, but only the parts of it, like this scalar top and whatever it decays to, that are most relevant. And so in particular, the simplest thing you might think about is a simplified model where you think about the stop, the scalar top. And it shouldn't be a stable particle, because if it was, we probably would have already seen it. And so it's decaying to a top quark and something that's invisible and stable that we wouldn't necessarily have seen so far. In particular, this invisible stable particle could be a dark matter candidate, although it doesn't have to be. So these simplified models can be more comprehensible. They tell us what we really want to know. And then you might try variations on them. Once we've decided we want to focus on this particle, we might also consider a gluino above it, which would just enhance the rate at which you can produce this thing at a collider. But we want to try to keep things simple instead of filling this thing up with all the different particles in the supersymmetry spectrum so that it can be more comprehensible. So one example of this is an extrapolation of the current LHC data that I did with Yevgeny Katz, Patrick Mead, and David Shi. And some other groups have been doing things along similar lines, where we simulated many of the searches that have been done at the LHC for different kinds of new physics and asked, what implications do these searches have for this particular simplified model, where we only consider a spectrum with a gluino, a stop, and in fact, in this case, a gravitino at the bottom, although that's not so important. The point is that it's a neutral, invisible particle. And so we simulated many different LHC searches. They're color-coded with different lines here. And this is the plane of the stop mass and the gluino mass. We assume the gluino is heavier, so we only consider things above this diagonal line. And in this plane, we found that there's a bound on the gluino mass of somewhere above 700 GeV, and it's coming from searches for same-sign dileptons. So the gluino can decay to a top and an anti-stop. For instance, the anti-stop decays to an anti-top. You have this on both sides of the event. And in the top, the corresponding top decays, you can have a top on one side of the event and a top on the other that both decay to leptons containing the same charge. And events with leptons that have the same sign don't happen very often in the standard model, so they're very clean signals of new physics, and that allows them to set very strong limits. And so there's an interesting limit here on the gluino, but what I would emphasize is that we didn't find any limit reaching up in a vertical branch of this curve, which means we didn't find a limit just on the stop itself. Okay, so why is it hard to find stops themselves? If you make a top quark, for instance, it might decay in some way. Say it'll decay to a B quark, a neutrino, and a lepton. And you can look for events that contain multiple B quarks, leptons, and missing energy, which is carried away by the neutrinos. On the other hand, if you make stops, they can decay in a very similar way. They decay to a top and some invisible particle. The problem is if you look at any of the final states that have leptons, you already had invisible particles in the standard model because you had neutrinos. And so your final state, just in terms of the basic objects that you see in your event, are the same. You see B quarks, leptons, and invisible, something invisible, missing momentum. And so it's not so easy to distinguish this from this. One thing you might notice is that you could just have more invisible stuff here, so you might have more missing momentum. But that's not always good enough. So if you look at, this is an extrapolation of what the current limits on the stop might be. And you shouldn't take the details of this too seriously, and it's kind of a messy plot. But the point is we're plotting as a function of the mass of the stop. What's the excluded cross-section divided by the cross-section that you expect for a stop? Which means wherever these lines cross one, anything below that mass may be excluded by the current data. On the other hand, these lines are typically at numbers like 2 or 3, and that means you're still a factor of 2 or 3 away from having enough sensitivity to say that you've excluded it. But now for larger stop masses, you can get these decays producing more invisible, more missing momentum, and really kinematically distinguish that from tops. On the other hand, in this region where the stop mass is becoming very near the top mass, you don't produce a lot of missing momentum because the stop and the top mass are nearly the same. That means that in that decay, there's not much phase space for the invisible particle to carry away much momentum. And that's an instance of a more general idea called stealth supersymmetry, which I've worked on recently with Gigi Fan and Josh Ruderman. And so the upshot of this plot is just that there may or may not be a bound somewhere around the top mass. The dashed lines here means we don't really trust our simulations to be completely doing the right thing in this region. Subtle differences between our model of the experimental detectors and the actual detectors could change this conclusion, so don't take it too seriously. But in any case, we think that it's definitely allowed that the stop could be light and it wouldn't have shown up yet. And so now one of the things that I'm spending a lot of time on is trying to think about how you would look for these things in a way that can really disentangle them from standard model top quark production in this limit where you don't have much more missing momentum than you would have had in the standard model. And so one thing you might try is you have events like this, you have some missing momentum, you have leptons. If this came from a standard model top, then the missing momentum came entirely from neutrinos from W decays. And there's a variable you can use which is called MT2 or transverse mass, which effectively tries to divide up this missing momentum into a sum of two particles in all possible ways. Then you can combine those two particles with the leptons to try to make things that may have come from a W boson. And you can ask if it's consistent with having come from a W boson like it would have in the standard model. And so this defines a variable, MT2, which has an edge at the W mass, which means that MT2 is plotted here on the right. The black histogram is standard model top quark events. And the histogram just cuts off above the W mass. Because kinematically, that's saying in those events, the missing momentum always comes from W's, and there's a limit to how much of it you can get. On the other hand, in the stop events, you have a tail that extends past the W mass. And so if you cut on that variable, you can effectively isolate a regime where you're pretty sure that whatever you're seeing didn't come from standard model top production, but it could have come from supersymmetric top production. If you did the same thing just with the amount of missing momentum itself, instead of this fancier variable that's constructed from it, you can see that all of these curves have sort of continuous tails that extend up very far, and you can still cut on that, and it would still buy you something, but it's not as efficient as cutting on this thing that has an edge. So that's one idea that I've suggested with some collaborators. And so at fixed signal efficiency, which is the horizontal axis, you can ask, what does this mean in terms of how much of the standard model top background you can throw away if you use this variable? So traditional methods that have used missing ET cuts, in particular an existing CMS search for events with two leptons and missing momentum, live at this point. And our method, at the same signal efficiency, lives up here. So you're going from rejecting something like 96% of the standard model background to rejecting more than 99% of it. So that's one useful thing to try. Another thing to try, and the next few things that I'm going to tell you about are work that I'm thinking about mostly with collaborators at Harvard now. One thing to try is that the top quark has spin, whereas scalar tops don't have spin. And when you produce two particles with spin, the spins can be correlated. And that correlation between the spins can lead, when they decay to more visible particles, can lead to correlations in the angular distributions of where those particles go. And in the case of supersymmetry, you're producing things without spin, and there is no such correlation. And now the color coding here isn't very useful because it's different in the two plots, but the point is just that you can construct observables that have some correlation.
So
what are
the axes?
OK, so the axes are, so you look at a top quark, which decays to various things, including a lepton, and you try to reconstruct the event and figure out where it came from. When you do that, you can ask what the rest frame of the top quark was. And in that rest frame, you can ask for the angle between the direction the lepton from the top quark decay came out at and the direction of the boost that takes you to the lab frame. And you can take the cosine of that angle. And so here, this is the cosine of that angle for the top and for the anti-top. And so there's some weak correlation between them in the standard model, and there's no correlation in the supersymmetric case. And the correlations here are all kind of weak, so this is maybe not that efficient on its own, and we're still working out exactly how much this buys you, but it's definitely a physical difference between tops and stops that you can try to exploit. Another physical difference, you can see if you start asking about the rate for making stops and tops, you only make stops with about a sixth of the top rate, even if they had the same mass. And if I'm very naive, I would say they're both color triplet particles. I'm making them from QCD. Why shouldn't I make them at the same rate, up to maybe a factor of two if I only have one of the stops that's light, so then I have fewer degrees of freedom. I can get a little insight on this by breaking things down. If I make them from gluons, I would have had, at leading order, a 68 picobarn rate for tops, an 11 picobarn rate for stops. If I make them from quark and anti-quark, I would have had 23 for tops and only 1.6 for stops. So there's clearly an even bigger discrepancy for quark and anti-quark than for gluons. In the case of quark and anti-quark, we can understand this pretty easily. It's because if you're producing a quark and an anti-quark, they're going into a gluon, which is then turning into this final state. When you're going through a gluon, you have to create the state in something that preserves angular momentum. You have to make a P wave, and the rate for making a P wave is suppressed near the threshold, so it goes like the velocity cubed instead of the velocity. So that explains why this number is small. On the other hand, when you make things from gluons, you don't have this P wave suppression. In both cases, the rate goes like the velocity, so there must be some other physics that's involved in explaining why there's this big discrepancy between this 68 and this 11. And we can understand that by looking at the massless limit. So if you make scalar tops, if they were massless, if you ask about the limit when the center of mass energy of the collision is much bigger than their mass, you can calculate the rate, and it just is some number times alpha s squared divided by s, the center of mass energy. On the other hand, if you ask the same question for making fermions, if you ask for making a quark and anti-quark from two gluons, if you calculate this rate, again in the massless limit, you find that it has T and U channel poles. And that means that there's a forward singularity. If you formally have a massless particle here and you try to integrate this, you have some kind of divergence for making them moving in the forward direction. And you have it for fermions and not for scalars. So what's happening for top quarks is that the rate is enhanced by this kind of forward singularity in a way that it isn't for scalars. And that's this divergence is cut off by the fact that the top quark is heavy, but on the other hand, it does lead to a real kinematic difference that we can exploit. And so don't have that much time to go through this in detail, but if you can sort of understand this in an even simpler setting, if you think of QED, if you think about scattering two photons into two scalar electrons or two electrons, and just ask what the helicity amplitudes are, then it's straightforward to write down the simplest helicity amplitudes that have the right scaling under the little group, and you can see that the thing that you would write down for scalars is a pure phase. So there's no overall scaling with the kinematic invariance in the problem, whereas in the case of making fermions, there is. It goes like the square root of u over t in this case, and some other helicity configuration will go like the square root of t over u. And when you put it all together, you get back this kind of behavior. OK. So that was a little bit formal in working in this massless limit to try to understand the physics. In terms of the actual limit with real heavy particles, if you simulate this for top quarks and for stops, you get distributions, the fraction of the events where you have a given rapidity difference between the top and the anti-top, which is some measure of whether they're close to this forward limit that we could see in the parton level amplitudes. You can see that the tops tend to happen at much larger rapidity differences, which is related to this fact that they're produced more often in the forward or backward direction, and the stops are produced more often in a more central way. So ultimately, this is somehow a result of the angular momentum properties of the final state here. And angular momentum conservation is eventually leading us to some kind of physical difference in measured distributions that we could try to use to exploit this. So this is actually for now, this is the conclusion of what I have to say about stops. And we're working on trying to put these things together and figure out how much actual reach the LHC has. But at this point, I don't have any definitive results I could show you for that. So in the remaining time, I want to talk about the Higgs boson. On December 13th, we had this very dramatic announcement from CERN that there were hints of a Higgs. And they showed us some beautiful pictures. So this is a Higgs boson decaying to two very energetic photons. At least this may be a Higgs boson decaying to two very energetic photons. And this may be a Higgs boson decaying to four leptons. And so we have these interesting events that look a lot like what you might expect a Higgs boson to look like. And when you put them together, ATLAS and CMS have both presented plots like this. And the plots are a little messy, but the point is that you have some curve here as a function of the Higgs mass. And wherever this curve dips, it means there's some sort of evidence that things don't look standard model-like near that dip. In particular, there's something like 3 sigma evidence at ATLAS for a Higgs at about 126 GeV. And at CMS, there are kind of two dips, one near 119 and one near 124. Or 125, and they're a little bit weaker than what ATLAS had to show us. So it's not definitive, but it's intriguing. And it became more intriguing this week. So Wednesday, at the Morion conference in Europe, ATLAS presented an update where they added some new channels into their analysis, and they actually claim that they can exclude essentially all Higgs masses that are not between 122 and 129. And in that region, they have an excess of significance, which is this bump here. There's also a very narrow window near 118 where they don't quite claim to exclude it at 95% confidence, but you know, maybe 94% confidence or something. So it's, yeah.
Two parts. You have to distinguish between the local probability and the Hilbert-Elsner effect.
That's right. Yeah.
The Hilbert-Elsner effect produces the probability.
That's right.
John, there is nowhere else to look right now. Everything is excluded. There's only one place to look at right now. There's no more look elsewhere effect.
Yeah, the other point is that the other channels, which are more difficult to measure, BB bar.
Right, there's certainly no evidence from BB bar showing up in these LHC results. That's right.
They don't look so good. Less than simple.
Well, WW star is going to give you a very broad feature because you can't cleanly see the mass, and they see some excess there, but I don't know how much stock to put in that particular channel at this point. BV bar is something that's very hard to see at the LHC, and so far it's not showing up here at all. So certainly there's still quite a bit more we would like to know before we say with confidence that this is the Higgs boson and that it looks like a standard model Higgs boson. But it's
calculate Higgs to two photons. addicted. It's a pimple. The actual events that are exceeding are 2 or 3 times bigger than it was predicted.
That's right. So yeah, there are some. There are some discrepancies in the apparent rate, but at this point the error bars are so big that I wouldn't attach much meaning to that. I think by the end of the year things will be much clearer. But for now, we have these hints, and we also have hints from the Tevatron, which have again a broad excess, so it's hard to pin down exactly what the mass is, but this may be a hint that it's showing up in BB bar at the Tevatron. And when you take all of these hints together, they start to form a compelling picture. It's not definitive yet, but it's at least becoming very interesting. And so we should ask what that implies for supersymmetry if this is the Higgs. So a Higgs of 125 is an extremely interesting number for supersymmetry. The reason is that in the minimal supersymmetric standard model, the tree level result for the Higgs boson mass is bounded above by the Z mass, which is only 90 GeV. So to get from 90 to 125, you need a pretty big correction. And in the minimal supersymmetric theory, that correction comes from loops of stops, so the same sorts of diagrams I was showing you that cancel the quadratic divergences, but there are leftover pieces that lead to some difference between the Higgs mass and the Z mass, which grows logarithmically with the mass of the stop quark. And there are also pieces that depend on a mixing parameter between the left and right-handed stops. And so with some collaborators, I worked out some of the implications of this, as have many other people since this result appeared. So our particular calculation showed that if we just want to make all the scalars heavy and not mix them, we need them to be something in the range of 5 to 10 TeV to make the Higgs this heavy. On the other hand, if we turn on this mixing parameter between left and right-handed stops, it can be of order a few TeV, and the stops can still be somewhat lighter than a TeV. But the upshot of all of this is that you need some parameter to be large, to be of order several TeV, whether that parameter is the stop mass itself or some kind of mixing parameter. In any case, you have some multi-TeV parameter here, and that's reintroducing part of the hierarchy problem that we wanted supersymmetry to solve. So it's a little bit tuned, and it's maybe not very satisfying. You can draw much stronger conclusions if you start asking about very specific models of supersymmetry. So one class of models that seemed very plausible until recently was something called general gauge mediation, where supersymmetry breaking happens in some sector that we don't understand yet, but its interactions could be transmitted to the standard model through the gauge forces that we know, and that makes specific predictions. One of the predictions that that makes is that the A term, so this mixing parameter of the left and right-handed stop, would be zero at the scale where supersymmetry breaking is communicated. On the other hand, if we want to say that the superpartners are not extremely heavy, we need this mixing parameter to be fairly large at low scales. And in order to make it large enough, it needs to be somehow driven from zero to something large by renormalization group effects. And those renormalization group effects then are driven primarily by the mass of the gluino. So the first conclusion is that in order to get a large enough low scale mixing parameter, the gluino has to be very heavy. Also, you have to run over many orders of magnitude, so the messenger scale would be at very high energies. And furthermore, if you do this calculation, you find that this renormalization group flow, any renormalization group flow that can do this, will also drive the mass of the top quarks, the scalar top quarks, tachyonic at high energies, which means there's another vacuum of the potential somewhere that breaks charge and color. And that potentially leads to cosmological problems. So it's not a very pretty picture. It means that your colored superparticles, the things that feel the strong force that you would have hoped to produce in large numbers at the LHC, become very heavy. Everything becomes kind of awkwardly tuned. You need very high scale gauge mediation. And there's still corners of parameter space that might work, but they're certainly not anywhere near the regions of parameter space that we were hoping that we might be living in. So large classes of models are already ruled out by the Higgs mass. And the most straightforward interpretation of this heavy Higgs mass, if you believe in supersymmetry, is just that things are mildly split. Maybe the scalars are at 10 TeV to 1,000 TeV, and you have some tuning. And that's one possibility. On the other hand, we can still think about natural interpretations, which is why I've been telling you about how to look for the stock, the thing that's canceling the quadratic divergence. But if we do that, we have to go beyond the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So, you know, we always talk about beyond the standard model physics, BSM physics, but here we need BMSSM physics, things that are supersymmetric but not the minimal version. And those can raise the Higgs mass. So my statement that I told you about needing these large loop corrections to raise the Higgs mass only applies if it has the minimal set of interactions. If it has other new interactions beyond the standard model, then those could also help to raise it. And in particular, if you have larger tree level effects on the Higgs mass, you can even have the stop be heavier at the same amount of fine tuning. And that's an interesting thing to think about. So I'm reaching the end of my time, I think. Let me just briefly remark. So one of the most common things that people talk about when they try to go beyond the minimal supersymmetric standard model is to add a singlet to the theory, which couples to the Higgses. That new interaction can then lift the Higgs mass. But on the other hand, once you start adding a singlet to your theory, you potentially have problems. So if it's really a singlet, and it's not charged under any symmetry, you can start writing down new Kähler potential operators, and this is an old observation of Bagger, Pappitz, and Randall. When you add these new Kähler potential operators involving a singlet, they can generate new terms in the potential that are tadpoles, that is linear terms in the singlet. And naively, you would think if you have supersymmetry, I told you it cancels the divergences from the Higgs mass, you would think it cancels every bad thing that can happen, because all of these new terms that you would generate are proportional to the amount of supersymmetry breaking. That's true here. You have this factor of m3/2 squared as some measure of the amount of supersymmetry breaking. But this is also still quadratically divergent, even though this is a supersymmetric theory. You have some powers of lambda here. And these quadratically divergent quantum corrections then can completely destabilize the hierarchy. They can give the singlet a very big term in its potential, which makes it get a very large vacuum expectation value. And then that wants to make the Higgses very heavy. So that's a danger. It's a danger that you can solve by saying that the singlet isn't really a singlet. It's charged under some symmetry that forbids the bad terms in its potential. And people do that frequently by talking about a Z mod 3 symmetry. On the other hand, once you have a Z mod 3 symmetry, any vacuum that you have in your theory actually comes in three copies. And that means that you can have domain walls between them and cosmological problems. And so I just want to, you know, this is well-known stuff, but I want to mention it because this is the sort of problem that you tend to run into once you go beyond the MSSM. You tend to find that whatever you do, there are usually tensions. So in order for one thing to work, you need to do something else, and then that can lead to its own problem. And things can become somewhat finely tuned. So you have to worry that you're not necessarily solving the problem you set out to solve. And one way that people try to get around this is to say that the singlet is a bound state of stuff that does have charge, and then these divergent contributions to its potential are cut off at the scale where you see that it's composite. And there are models along these lines. So that's one interesting direction people are going now. On the other hand, these things tend to have their own problems. So to sort of summarize where we are, the Higgs at 125 GeV leads us in two possible directions. One is we do have the minimal supersymmetric standard model, but the scalars are heavy. In that case, electroweak symmetry breaking is tuned, so it's maybe less satisfying than you might have hoped. On the other hand, often if you start with a top-down theory, you find it predicts this, so that's interesting. And you can still look for things like gluinos, which might still be light. On the other hand, we could go beyond the MSSM and it's natural, and in that case, the models tend to be awkward and complicated. On the other hand, there's a robust experimental connection in that case, because if things are natural, you know you can look for the scalar top. So that's where I'm concentrating at the moment. But certainly, we would hope to have some experimental input that can help us distinguish which of these two classes of ideas we're living in. So to conclude, the LHC is going to probe the hierarchy problem in a direct way. We can help to ask the right questions by using simplified models that tell us which particles we're really most concerned about. And in particular, for canceling the divergences in the standard model, it's the scalar top. And I'm working a lot on thinking about better ways to find that. If the Higgs is really there at 125 GeV, then we have a whole new set of questions that come with that. We might want to think about theories that are tuned. We might want to think about theories that are not tuned, in which case things like gauge coupling unification become trickier. A lot of the reasons that we believed in supersymmetry to begin with start to become a little bit more complicated and less appealing. So we have a lot of challenges, and hopefully the data will soon start pointing us in the right direction. So thank you.
I just wondered about your philosophy of supersymmetry that you're using here. I guess you're
Yeah.
You're not worrying about what actually happens in the intersector or whatever else. But one of the things that's always puzzled me is that anytime you pick, well, if you have unbroken strings, you have a zero cosmic constant, it goes with it because the vacuum energy is zero.
Well, that's not entirely true. You can have a negative cosmological constant with supersymmetry.
Well, I mean, just rigid strings.
Right, you can have a negative cosmological constant. No.
What?
You can have anti-de-Sitter space that's supersymmetric.
I'm talking about just rigid Susie. There's no anti-de-Sitter space in rigid Susie.
No, it's just all.
Yeah, there's a. Yeah.
Well, okay, but anytime that you break, Susie, you're going to get a big vacuum expectation value, like group 11, right? This is the old
sure.
Weinberg. But so I wonder about the philosophy. Somewhere along the line, there's spontaneous breaking of Susie, and there's this huge cosmic constant, right?
Right.
That's a Google level. And yet, you're worrying about things, you know, you're worrying about the hierarchy problem, and you're worrying about 20% here and 10% here.
Right.
How is it that you do that without worrying about the cosmic constant?
That's a reasonable question, and it's one where I think most of us in the field are always sort of ignoring the cosmological constant problem because it looks overwhelmingly difficult. And the hierarchy problem looks potentially solvable. But certainly there's some kind of philosophical tension there, that if we believe the cosmological constant is not natural, then you can certainly ask, why does everything else have to be natural?
Yeah.
It's a reasonable question, and I don't have a sharp answer to it.
Do you have any, so your philosophy is, oh my God, I'm not and that's reasonable, I mean, I agree.
But you know, one thing I would point out is that if you had supersymmetry, if you believe that the theory is at some fundamental level supersymmetric, and the supersymmetry is really badly broken, so none of these superpartners are near the TeV scale, then actually 125 GeV Higgs tends to be a little bit too light. It's actually not so easy then to explain it if you had supersymmetry with all the superpartners very heavy.
So you at least solved 50% of the problem.
Yeah.
But also because you bring it down from tuning all the way to one scale. Are there
questions
in the back?
John? Here comes from last Wednesday, my own. Higgs of two garbage CMS electrons. There are actually three pumps. One at 19.5, one at 156.5, one at 136.
Mm-hmm.
136 and one 19.5 are two systems. One in the middle is bigger.
Right.
So I know it's all put in the way. But what if it's 136?
Well, I think they're claiming that 136 is ruled out by the combination of all the channels. I'm not sure at that.
No.
Right. Like if you look at the atlas.
It's in the globe, it should be
arranged. And so if you look at the atlas combination, 136 looks pretty strongly disfavored, right? Right. Well, I would say that, so if it was a standard model Higgs giving you that bump in photons, then it appears to be ruled out by other things. Now, you could wonder if something that is not standard model Higgs is also producing a two-photon signal there. And I think you have to wait for more data.
But supposedly
up to what?
600 GeV.
Yeah, that's right.
So if Higgs is getting up to 800 GeV, you start violating Unitard's perturbation theory.
Yes.
If it's too small, or 19, you start getting vacuum insecurity.
Right. I think in this range around 125, it's slightly unclear if the vacuum is stable or not in the standard model. It's sort of on the edge. But it's metastable enough that we could live there happily with no problems. So.
We are living happily. How would we go and live happily over